Welcome to Cut and Thrust, your podcast for the bloody and sometimes bizarre journey through the Middle Ages. Whether it's dark battles, questionable hygiene, or hair-raising rulers, here you'll get history as it really was, raw and unfiltered. So grab your sword, put on your helmet, and let's dive into the wild world of the past.
Hello and welcome to a new episode of the Battle Merchant podcast. I'm Hendrik.
And I'm Carmen. Today, we're talking about a sword that, well, honestly sounds more like fantasy than history.
The Ulfberht sword, a name straight out of an epic. And when you look at what this sword could actually do, you understand why it inspired legends.
Okay, but let's start from the beginning. What time period are we actually talking about?
8th to 11th century. So exactly the period we now know as the Viking Age. Those 300 years when Scandinavian warriors terrorized northern and central Europe.
And most people immediately picture, well, bearded men in horned helmets bashing away wildly.
Exactly that cliché. The Vikings as primitive.
Barbarians. When, in fact, they were technologically more advanced than their neighbors in many ways. Their ships, their navigation, and of course, their swords.
That's the crucial point. The Ulfberht sword wasn't some crude hacking weapon. It was high tech. People sometimes say it was centuries ahead of its time, which is an oversimplification, of course, but it gives you the right idea.
And how do we know it was really that special?
Well, first of all, the material. The steel was different. But we'll get into that in more detail shortly. Second, and this is almost equally fascinating, the name.
The name on the blade?
Authentic Ulfberht swords typically bear this inscription in the fuller. The most common variant is plus VLF BERH plus T. That is, plus VLF BEERH plus T. But there are other authentic spellings as well.
And how did they get that into the blade, into a finished blade?
That was technically really impressive. They took pattern welded iron wires, hammered them into grooves, and then ground them flush. Later examples also used thin iron sheet.
That sounds like an enormous amount of work.
It was. And here's the thing. If the smith made a mistake during this process, a wire slipped, the structure was weakened, then in the worst case, the blade was ruined.
The whole blade? Because of an inscription?
Because of an inscription. Month of work, valuable materials, all down the drain.
Oh, so that's why it was such a, what's the word, a mark of quality?
Yes, exactly. Essentially a prestigious workshop inscription. Anyone who took that risk and pulled it off was proving, we can do this. We're so skilled that we dare to attempt it.
So basically one of the first luxury weapon brands in Europe.
Something like that. And it worked. The name Ulfberht had a reputation. Warriors wanted this sword. It was expensive, it was rare, and it was superior.
And who was Ulfberht himself? The smith?
That's uncertain. The name originates from the Frankish realm. Could have been a mastersmith, but could also have been a patron. Perhaps even a churchman, an abbot or bishop.
The church as a weapons manufacturer?
Sounds strange, but it's not far-fetched. The actual production centers were secularly organized. Upper Franconia, Passau, Cologne. But the church controlled land and resources so it could commission work. At any rate, the church organized the fight against the pagan Norsemen. Although the irony is, of course,
that the swords ended up with the Vikings.
The Vikings were also excellent traders. And sometimes, well, they just took what they wanted.
Raiding and trading expeditions.
Both. That's what sets them apart from the barbarian stereotype. They had an extensive trade network, all the way to Constantinople,
all the way to the Orient. And along these routes traveled not just goods, but knowledge as well.
And possibly also the secret of the steel?
That's one of the big questions. But we'll get to that next. Why this steel was so different and where it may have come from. But now to the real question. Why was this sword so different? It comes down to the material. And to understand that, we need to briefly discuss the problem that all smiths in the early Middle Ages faced.
The slag problem.
The slag problem. The bloomery furnaces back then produced iron blooms with a lot of slag in them. Smiths would then refine and forge weld it. They could produce usable steel that way, but often with inclusions. Slag, stone remnants, all sorts of impurities.
And that makes the blade porous and brittle.
And inflexible. Imagine you strike a shield. Your blade bites into the wood and snaps. Or it's so rigid that it shatters on the first hard impact. That was everyday life for medieval warriors.
That's why all the composite techniques, pattern welding and so on.
Pattern welding was essentially the workaround. You took different steel layers, some harder, some softer, and forge welded them together in an elaborate process. That way, you could offset the disadvantages of one material with the advantages of another.
That's similar to the Japanese...
Katana blades, same principle. Japanese smiths also didn't have perfect raw material, so they folded and welded. 10 to 20 times, that produced thousands of layers.
That's why those characteristic patterns on katanas. It's essentially the signature of the folding process.
And it worked. But it was incredibly labor-intensive. Weeks, sometimes months of work for a single blade.
And the Ulfbert smiths found a way around that?
They had a different approach. They used improved bloomery furnaces. These are shaft furnaces where iron ore is heated with charcoal. And through better control of these furnaces, they could extract the iron much more purely.
So less slag from the start?
Much less. And then comes the crucial step. Through better control of the smelting process, they achieved a higher, more consistent carbon content in the steel. The result was an extremely pure, homogeneous steel.
And carbon makes the difference?
Carbon makes the steel harder, and at the same time, this sounds paradoxical, but with proper processing, also tougher. The carbon content in Ulfbert blades was between 0.5 and 1.5%, significantly higher than in other swords of the period, often 2 to 3 times as much. That's a massive difference.
3 times as high?
Exactly. And because of that, they had a single homogeneous material structure. No more layers, no folding needed. One blade, significantly more robust than most of its contemporaries.
People often say the sword was 500 years ahead of its time.
You hear that everywhere, yes. But that's obviously an oversimplification. It wasn't as if no one else could produce good steel. The technique was known, just extremely rare and expensive. The Ulfbert smiths had access to this knowledge and the resources.
And where that knowledge came from is still debated.
There are stories about trade routes to the Orient, Persia, India. They had crucible steel traditions there long before. One theory suggests that ingots of this high-quality steel came to Europe via these routes and were then worked by Frankish smiths.
European furs for Oriental steel?
Something like that. That would also explain why this process disappeared from Europe again after the 11th century. When the trade routes changed, the knowledge may have been lost as well.
That's really fascinating. A global product in the 8th century.
But the practical impact on the battlefield, that was enormous. And that's what we should talk about next.
Now it's getting interesting. The material is one thing, but how did the Ulfbert perform in actual combat?
That's where theory meets practice. Because the sword wasn't just made of better steel. It also had a completely different shape.
The blade tapers significantly toward the point. That sounds simple at first, but it changes everything.
In the early Middle Ages, chainmail was a real luxury item. Only nobility and wealthy warriors could afford it. Thousands of small metal rings riveted together. It protects well against cuts.
But against thrusts?
With most swords, no problem for the armor. They simply couldn't get through riveted mail. But the Ulfbert had this needled point. It could slip between the rings.
And then what?
Tests with replicas have shown that the needle point could damage the rings on a targeted thrust. Some were burst at the rivet, others were cut through or bent.
Bursting rivets? Out of chainmail?
Out of solid chainmail. That's quite remarkable.
That means even good chainmail with a gambeson underneath, which was considered excellent protection at the time, wasn't completely safe against such a specialized weapon.
Plate armor didn't come along until much later. In the early Middle Ages, a mail coat was the best you could have, and even that wasn't enough.
So the advantages were the point against armor, then...
The material quality against shields. That's almost even more important.
Why?
Picture a shield wall. Wooden shields packed tightly together. You strike, your blade bites into the wood, and gets stuck.
That's a death trap.
An absolute death trap. Your opponent just has to wait until you try to pull your blade free. In that moment, you're completely exposed.
And with the Ulfbert?
The sharper blade cut itself free from the wood instead of getting stuck. And this high-quality steel was uniform and free of impurities, so it could be heat-treated optimally. Hard enough for a sharp edge, but with proper tempering also tough enough not to break. That made the blade more reliable in combat.
So you stay in the fight.
You keep the initiative. That's vital for survival in close combat.
And then there's the point of balance. You notice that immediately if you've held different swords.
What do you mean?
With many modern replicas, especially the cheaper ones, the point of balance is far forward, almost at the middle of the blade. That makes the weapon blade heavy. After a few minutes, your arm starts to ache.
With well-made swords, whether Ulfbert or others, the point of balance was closer to the hilt. There's no risk of it flying out of your hand.
Faster strikes.
Less effort.
Greater endurance.
You could guide the blade from the wrist and forearm, not from the shoulder. During long fights or on raids, that was a huge advantage.
Other blades shattered in close combat, but the Ulfbert was far more resilient. The slag-free steel broke much less often than other swords of its time.
That's how it was described, at least. And when you consider how many of these swords have survived over 1,000 years...
There must have been something to it.
It's the combination that matters. Better steel, better shape, better balance. Altogether, it produced a weapon that offered real advantages on the battlefield.
But who could afford a sword like this? It wasn't exactly mass-produced.
That's an important point. And that's where it gets interesting. Because the Ulfbert wasn't just a weapon.
And now, a quick word from our sponsor. Feeling curious? Then head over to battlemerchant.com. They've got all sorts of medieval stuff, from costumes to armor and loads more. Totally worth a look.
That brings us back to the question of where the steel came from, which we touched on earlier. Let's dive deeper into that now.
You mentioned the theory about the Oriental trade routes.
There are stories about ancient trade routes to the Orient. It's believed that Norsemen and Franks gained access to crucible steel and its secrets through these routes.
And what did they trade for it?
European furs. Those were a sought-after trade good at the time. Pales for high-quality steel. If that's true, it was quite a good deal for Europe.
That would also explain why the process disappeared again later.
When the trade routes changed from the 11th century onward, the know-how may have been lost as well. European smiths did improve their blimmery techniques, but true crucible steel of that quality? That didn't return until industrialization.
But the name, Ulfbert, that's not an Oriental name.
As we've already established, the name is Frankish. What's particularly interesting, though, is the theory we briefly mentioned earlier, that it might not have been a smith, but a church patron.
Someone else entirely?
Exactly, the church theory. In the early Middle Ages, some monasteries had their own forges. Fulda and Lorsch, for example, are documented as production sites. With the resources for high-quality weapons, especially in the fight against the pagan Norsemen.
So Ulfbert could have been an
abbot or bishop who commissioned the swords. The astronomical material costs and the complicated processing point to a wealthy patron.
The church having swords forged against the Vikings.
So the success was questionable.
Why?
The weapons ended up pretty quickly in the hands of exactly the people they were meant to fight against.
Oh, with the Vikings themselves?
With the Vikings themselves.
That's really... There's a certain irony to that.
The church pays for super weapons against the pagans, and the pagans end up wielding them in battle. Whether through trade, plunder, or spoils of war, the result was the same.
That's why they're called Viking swords.
Even though they probably weren't originally made by Vikings. But they had them, they used them, and the name stuck.
And then came the counterfeiting.
The Ulfbert name had such a good reputation that other smiths started copying it. Numerous fakes appeared, with the name in the fuller, but made of significantly inferior steel.
So basically like counterfeit brand goods today.
Early medieval product piracy. The counterfeiters took the risk of engraving. One mistake and the blade was ruined, but they cut corners on the material.
And how would you tell? I mean, a buyer at the market could hardly run a lab test.
In doubt, only in combat. When the blade broke or bent, then you knew. But by then, it was too late.
That's pretty ruthless.
Today, authentic Ulfbert blades can be identified through metallurgical analysis. The carbon content, the purity of the steel, that can be measured. We are talking about approximately 170 surviving swords from 23 countries. And what the analysis shows is, a significant portion of them are actually fakes or inferior copies.
A lot?
A significant portion. But that also shows how desirable the brand was. Nobody counterfeits something that has no value.
So the Ulfbert sword wasn't just a weapon, but also a status symbol.
And that brings us to the final point, what this sword really meant to the people of that era. So, the Ulfbert was more than a weapon, and to put that in context, most warriors in the early Middle Ages didn't even fight with swords.
Spears and axes, that was the standard equipment.
Swords were reserved for the elite. That came down to the material, the effort required to make them, and of course, the cost.
And the Ulfbert was another level above that?
The Ulfbert represented the absolute pinnacle of craftsmanship of its time. Even among swords, it was the top tier. Only the particularly wealthy nobility could afford one.
And sometimes it wasn't even used in combat.
Often not. It served as a noble status symbol, as an insignia for high dignitaries. A sword that hung on the wall or was worn at ceremonies.
How did you even get one of these swords? Could you just buy one?
Buy, inherit, receive as a gift, or capture. In noble families, such weapons were passed down through generations. Owning an Ulfbert sword said something about your family.
And this fascination with exceptional swords, it runs through all of...
cultural history! From antiquity to the present day.
When you think of Valyrian steel in Game of Thrones, a lot of it is reminiscent of the Ulfbert, a rare, superior material whose manufacturing secret has been lost.
The parallels are striking. Whether George R. R. Martin knew about the Ulfbert, we don't know. But the concept is the same.
Or Mithril in Tolkien. Light, indestructible, only for the worthy.
And if we go back even further, Siegfried's Balmung, Excalibur. These mythical blades that set their bearers apart.
That's exactly the point. A sword as proof that you're someone special.
The Ulfbert was real, but it already had something mythical about it back then. The combination of superior material, mysterious origin, and that name inscribed in the blade.
No wonder it captures the imagination, then and now.
And I think that's also why we are still fascinated by it. It connects, well, real history with what we imagine legendary weapons to be.
The reality was at least as fascinating as the fiction. Possibly Oriental crucible steel, possibly high-quality European steel, Frankish smiths with superior technique, Vikings as the end users. It's a global adventure.
Yeah, and 1,000 years later, we are still talking about it.
Which also shows that fine craftsmanship is timeless.
Absolutely. And with that, we've come to the end of today's episode.
We hope you had as much fun as we did diving into the world of the Ulfbert sword.
If you want to learn more about historical weapons, armor, and everything medieval, head over to battlemerchant.com. You'll find lots more fascinating topics on the blog.
And of course, an extensive selection for anyone who doesn't just want to read about history, but live it.
Until next time.
Bye.
And so we ride towards the end of this episode. Keep your sword sharp and your mugs full. We'll catch you in the next one.